Tereo Ererangi o Te Mānia. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout. And today I'm talking with Brian Woolpit about his novel, Empathy, that was long listed for this year's Ockham Book Awards. It's a terrific read, very tightly plotted and fascinating. And Marianne is talking to poet and writer Joanna Emeny about a wonderful new book called Horses and Us. It's really an anthology of stories about people's relationships with their horses, and it has some wonderful illustrations by Sarah Lang, who she's written short stories as well as doing illustrations. If you've got a horsey person in the family, this book will be absolutely for you. And then we're going to end with a great monthly chat, our monthly get-together with Claudia from Scorpio, our wonderful sponsors. She's going to be talking about what's coming up this month in the shop, what events are happening, and who's reading what. Empathy, Brian Woolpit's latest novel, was long listed for this year's Ockham Book Awards. Brian is a poet, an essayist, and a scholar, as well as a novelist. And he teaches at Massey University as a professor of creative writing. His earlier novel, Entanglement, was also, it was a finalist for the Jan Medlicott Acorn Prize in 2022 at the Book Awards. Empathy and Entanglement, is there a link here between choosing titles that start with E?
Actually, there are two others I've written that start with an E. My short story collection, Ephraim's Eyes, and my first poetry collection, Etymology. And I didn't realize I was establishing a pattern, or I would have had them all be E's, I guess. But I've gotten a little teased by that by some friends. I don't have an E for the next one, though.
Oh, that's fine. I thought it would probably be a random thing. Brian, I read that you have an interest in marrying intellect with feeling. And so it is no wonder in a way that you have chosen empathy as a theme? It permeates the book in so many different ways.
Right. Sure. I'd call it a theme. Yes. Well, I've always had a real interest in both in the poetry and in the fiction, in working with science and philosophy. And I think for a couple reasons. One, just the intellectual interest in it. But aesthetically, I think that drawing in science the objectivity of science can in some ways heighten feeling around it.
Yeah, because it's based in logic, reason, whatever, but it's got that other elusive thing going on there.
Yeah, I think sometimes it offers a little bit of a distance too, which helps to put the feeling of things more into relief rather than inhibiting it. I think that was the case with Entanglement. Maybe with Empathy, it's playing less of that sort of role, but science is just so interesting and so exciting and has so many metaphor qualities and just offers itself in so many ways to plot and to theme and to metaphor.
Yes, because this is a complex book, because on the one hand, there's a mystery going on. It's a thriller. There's psychological things involved, but you very much root it in domesticity in a good way, in people's stories and in their everyday, what's going on for them in the everyday, as well as what's driving the plot.
Right. So I think that's the everyday, the domestic, is my happy place or sad place, depending on the book, but is where I'm, I think that's where most of my interest lies. And it's true in the poems as well. The thriller aspect developed as I was writing this, because I didn't set out to write a thriller. I didn't think to myself, now I'm going to try the thriller genre. That aspect of the book emerged as I was writing. Also, I set myself a challenge to write 1,000 words a day, 5 days a week, except on holidays and my birthday. I also skipped the day there was that big cyclone in Auckland, because I was up all night. Other than that, it was 5 days a week. And I think if you're pushing 1,000 words a day, you gravitate towards some sort of plot to help you drive it.
Yeah.
So I think that was part of it. Yeah.
Because that's something that is very tightly plotted, and it is very pacey. I started off, you know, as I often do with novels, with reading a bit, putting it down, reading a bit. And then I realized with your novel, I couldn't do it. I had to actually make time for myself to sit down and stay with the novel to find out what happened.
Oh, that's great. That's what I want to hear. That's wonderful. I'm glad that it was driving you that way. That's nice to hear.
Definitely pulled me in. So we start with Edward, who's an older man, a chemist. It's set in the US, but there are New Zealand connections there. He's just been kidnapped. Why is he in the back of a car?
Right. Well, we don't know.
No,
he's in the back of a Lexus and in the boot of a Lexus, and is not sure what's going to happen next. Thoughts racing, and feeling the first indications of his heart reacting to the situation. And I think I wanted to set up that mystery right from the start. I also wanted to introduce Edward right from the start, since his absence is central to everything that follows.
And his contribution to what has set this whole thing off is absolutely paramount, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. His manufacture of a perfume which produces empathy is at the center of the plot. Though when I started the book, I had no idea that's what he would do. So I was interested to find out that that's what happened. It gradually emerged. That's what he did. All I knew was that the book was going to involve when I started, I knew it would involve David, who's a science teacher. I knew it would involve a father. I knew it would somehow involve perfume. I knew it would involve magic, though magic ended up playing a very small role in the book, even though my initial Word file name was Magic Novel. So you never know where a book's going to go.
I'm always intrigued with that. That is magical, really, isn't it? That you can start off with those elements and for it to take charge.
Yeah, I was surprised. I didn't, for example, the other couple in the book, you know, Allison, the other, you know, one of the major characters, and her husband. I didn't really know Allison was going to be in the book until I got to that chapter, and had no idea that she would play such a central role, or that her husband would play such a central role in developing a game called Empath. So,
yeah, and I want to talk about the playing of that game, Empath, because sure. I would have thought it's because I'm not a gamer, obviously, not in the demographic, although how do I know? that's supposition. I would have thought that having that game being played towards the latter part of the novel would turn me off completely, but it didn't at all, because, you know, you move away from what's happening in the actual line of the narrative to put us in this game called Empath. And I just found that a really interesting device, because I didn't feel sort of impatient with it at all.
Well, that's good to hear. You know, Lloyd-Jones said something similar when he read the book. He said his first reaction was, uh-oh, don't go there.
Yeah.
But then he ended up liking it. He was surprised, which is gratifying to hear. I, at first, did not intend to write from within the game, but I eventually realized I sort of had to, that the way the book was going was requiring me to give a sense of what that game was like. And the only way to really give a sense was to put someone in it. So I approached that a little worried about how that was going to go. So it was fun in its own way, but certainly very different. And I remember I went to my son for some advice about gaming language, and my agent at the time also gave me a little feedback on the gaming language to make it a little bit better. But it was fun. Yeah.
Yeah, the game, for listeners, involves people having to empathize and to try and work out, to make decisions, but try and find out what the other person who's playing with them would be thinking and choosing as well. And your success in the game relies on you two being in empathy with each other, doesn't it?
Yeah, and without directly communicating.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
They can do little communications like indicate satisfaction or dissatisfaction, but not actually communicate within the game. And you're always playing with a stranger. You're always put together with someone else playing online, so that you don't know each other already. Mm. So therein lies the empathy challenge. It's it plays with a notion of empathy that comes from something called theory of mind, which is what humans are good at, which is getting a sense of what other people are thinking.
Yeah, and it's a good thing to have. Because the other thing, you know, going back to the main part of the plot, is that Edward, the chemist, has created this perfume that suddenly allows you to be empathetic, but that it also allows you to be manipulated. So it becomes a very valuable potion, doesn't it?
Right. The idea is that the chemical that he's created works too well. Instead of giving a little bit of empathy that they can market as part of their perfume, it makes you very empathetic, so empathetic that you are easily manipulated, because you want so much to help someone, whatever their situation is. However, even if you would not normally want to empathize or help that person.
Yeah, so it becomes, it's the thing that people, the magic potion that people want to get their hands on. But
yeah,
I loved
a good thing. Yeah.
Yeah, but I love the way you bring in the backstories of David, Edward's son. He's a widower. He's bringing up two children. the grief is still pretty present in his life. And then also, you know, the backstories of people like Alison and Jim. Alison, who is sort of potentially one of the evil people, but because you know what her backstory is, you can't see her like that.
That's good to hear. Yeah, I felt like empathy should be pervasive throughout in how we can see the characters and understand their motivations, and that almost no one is all bad. And that the performing of that empathy, I hoped, was part of the pleasure of the book. That was the goal. It's also something that I enjoy, is thinking through how do characters feel? What motivates them? Why are they doing what they do? And sort of deepening that. I always enjoy reading it, that, and I wanted to give that experience to the reader as well.
Yeah, those are the books that I enjoy, that I can leave myself and try and understand motivations and how experience shapes us. So thank you, Brian. I can see why it was long-listed. It's a tremendously well-written book and hugely satisfying.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that, and appreciate your interest in the book.
It was a joy to read. The book is called Empathy. It's by Brian Wolpert, and it's published by Makaro Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Horses and Us is a surprising and rich book. Surprising because, believe me, I'm no horse nut. Of course, I love them in a generic way, have ridden a bit like many rural Kiwis of my generation, but my daughter's incipient pony enchantment was a spell I resisted. I didn't know how I could support a horse life and pursue a corporate career. And, well, this anthology of artfully captured and illustrated stories made me regret not finding a way. The book is all about the beauty, meaning, and inspiration to be celebrated in the bonds between people and horses in Aotearoa. Horsey, sporting, and te ao Māori tikanga are all shape these stories. Health, community, cultural heritage, ambition, empowerment, the wairua that binds people, animals, and whenua, these stories capture it all. People and animals are alive on every page. It's my pleasure to be chatting with author Joanna Emeny on Bookends this morning. Tēnā koe, Joanna. Thanks for joining us.
Kia ora. That was a lovely introduction.
Yeah, well, it really is a beautiful book. It's not your first illustrated book about the bonds between people and animals, is it? Your first one, Sylvie and the Birds, was shortlisted for New Zealand Children's Book Awards just a couple of years ago. Birds Now Horses.
That's right. I was saying to Sarah Lang, with whom I created Sylvia and the Birds, that we've gone from hoiho to hoiho, the little penguins, the little ponies.
Indeed. I wouldn't have come up with that wordplay myself. That's lovely. So what's the special draw card in the relationships between people and animals for you as a writer?
I guess it's more for me as a person. I don't have children, and I've had a lifetime of teaching, so I guess both my husband and I have enjoyed children in that way. But our biggest love is animals, and I think that writing is such a pleasure in that it enables you to share the things you love with the world. You know, writing, the aim of writing is making the personal universal, and so I love to share my enjoyment, my pleasure in nature and animals with people through writing.
Yeah, lovely. And I want to talk about Sarah, whom you've mentioned, but about actually all the illustrators. So Sarah Lang, Ali Teow, Lisa Allen, Ross Hamilton, Isabel Te Aho White, and the cover artist also, Amy Harhoff.
Yes.
Yeah, so these illustrations, they are diverse, they're lively, painterly, they're really engaging, they really help make the book. How did you find the illustrators? And tell us also, if you don't mind, about working with illustrators when you're a storyteller like this.
Well, it's such a pleasure. I can't imagine being a writer who just writes copy and then hands it over to be illustrated by someone whom the publisher picks. Because for me, everything about writing and the production of a book is personal. So first of all, I knew that Sarah had to be the person who would illustrate the chapter about my little dream pony, Billy. And it means so much that she has that first chapter and then the afterword that deals with Billy and his time in hospital. Mm-hmm. I did some research, which helped me to match the different illustrators with their different kaupapa in terms of, you know, which chapter would suit which illustrator's style, in my opinion. And I think they've all done beautiful jobs. And I knew of Ross Hamilton because I love goats. My husband and I have goats, and we loved his Goat on a Trampoline book. And I knew already of Izzy Te Aho White because her books are just so incredible. And I knew already the chapter that I would love her to work on. And then it was just a matter of going into libraries, going into bookshops and searching through the books and seeing whose styles I really loved and where they would fit. And this was just a pleasure and a revelation, really. We also have in the book artwork by Liam Barr, which is just incredible and gives young readers the chance, and older readers, the chance to engage with his beautiful works and interpret them. And also there's a beautiful piece of modern photography by Geoffrey Heath, which young readers can have a little go at interpreting too, because I think every opportunity that young people have to engage with art in all its forms is really rich.
There's an early chapter as well with the Impressionist artist, and I've forgotten her name, but there's a beautiful Impressionist, kind of modern Impressionist picture from a graphic artist early in this, whose story is early in the book.
Michelle Clark is just incredible from Ototahi, Christchurch. Michelle, I've really admired for years and years and followed her Instagram and her Facebook, because not only is she a show photographer, going from show to show and recording people's jumping, dressage, etc., she's carved out a real niche for herself and as a businesswoman in her own right, just creating these incredible watercolors, and she does some funny little chonky pony designs with quirky sayings that are really inspiring, some of them, and really touching, that they've really touched the whole nation with how wholesome they are. And so Michelle was one of the first people I approached to be in the book. And she's just a really good role model for young people who find that art is their calling, and yet they don't find that they fit into the traditional model that is sometimes pushed on young arty people of, oh, you must take that to university, because Michelle found that university didn't actually fit her art. She took her art outside university and made a career through her own love of art and her own style and engaging with an audience herself, which is just fantastic.
And engaging her art with her passion for horses as well. So, you know, there's that, so the theme of creativity is the first theme in the book, and And I think, you do talk, you just mentioned that really well with relation to the visual arts, photography and those artist stories, but you also use the two poems really beautifully in here in the book as well. So I think that the place of art in expressing our love for animals is really one of the strong themes. But there are these other three themes that are your organising chapters for the book: rising fast, bloodlines, and healing horses. Can you just give us an overview of how it came to you that those were the overarching themes that you would use to?
Well, it kind of is inverse to that, in that first of all, I chose the subjects of the book, and I did that in various ways. So first of all, I chose people, for example, Michelle, whom I loved and followed on social media and whose careers I was really interested in, like gorgeous Stacey Gregg, who was amazing at our recent launch. She did a Q&A with me and was just utterly delightful. And then what I did was I thought, well, what groups these different subjects together? And I found that it did seem to lie in such a way that you had the people in the creative fields, you had some gunny young writers doing well in their individual disciplines. You had those who helped with healing horses and who were healed in turn by horses. And then you had people who kind of grew up with horses in the blood, you know. They grew up on the back of a horse. They were born riding, as it were. I always thought you had to be like that to be someone who truly connected with horses. But some of the stories showed me that that was wrong, and you could come late to it and still be very, very gifted in the saddle. And then I suppose after, what was that one, Bloodlines, when people were kind of born into the saddle. Did I have another one?
No, you've already mentioned it, the healing horses one.
Them.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah, so no, that was them, and that was a lovely kind of little snapshot, and it's a bit like a research project, and that was my other question. So you said you chose your subjects first, but I was kind of interested about how you found them. Did people refer each other like in a snowball type effect, and you collected the stories and then you found the themes? That reminds me of research, you know. Was this published by Auckland University Press? That's an interesting question. Did you undertake it with a research methodology or in?
So it was published by Massey University Press.
Sorry.
And I did my PhD with Massey University. And, of course, PhDs teach you a lot about research. First of all, when you do a PhD, you do a literature research. You see what's available on your topic, you know. You see what's been done and what's missing. And so that was like the first step, you know, going around what horse books exist, what horse books don't exist, what would I like to exist. And so the next thing was, who has been profiled strongly in the media, who hasn't? So, you know, people like Stacey and people like gorgeous Whittemu Priest from Young Riders, they have a really strong presence. And so what story about them could I tell that hadn't been told? Then it was picking up stories that were little tiny ones that I could sweep out of corners, but which were beautiful. For example, a young woman whose horse was painted on a shed by the visual artist, Mr. G.
Mr. G.
And that was just a little story that I found in the corner of a horse and pony magazine, a bunch of which I bought on Trade Me, you know, archive stock of Horse and Pony magazine. And I just found this little story and found it rather enchanting, and the backstory to it.
You paid? Hang on, you paid for archive stock of Horse and Pony magazine?
I did, because I thought I'd find some really neat little tiny stories.
Yeah, I just love that you had to pay for it. I love that somebody's put that up on Trade Me. That's gorgeous.
Well, you find all sorts of things on Trade Me, I tell you. but, you know, this little story was charming enough, but beneath that was the fact that Lucy, the girl in question, had been suffering from seizures brought on by, she got a bang on the head in sports class from a basketball hitting her. And she'd been suffering from these seizures, and she'd had to give up riding, and she'd fallen in love with a beautiful horse called Cloud, and she became so depressed that her neurologist said, go on then, get back on a horse, but be really careful. And lovely Cloud took such good care of her, and she was so bonded to him, and she was riding one day, and then out came Mr. G from the beach with his dog and said, oh, it's a beautiful horse, you know. Like, I can imagine painting him right there on that shed. And he kind of just lifted her, you know. He gave her a really precious moment, a taonga moment, and immortalised her beautiful horse on that shed. And it's just, it's got what I love to write about, which is, you know, really heartwarming. It's a heartwarming story that kind of lifts you. And I wanted there to be something for every person in the book that would make them feel good. And if they were having a moment where they needed resilience, it would tell them that they could survive, you know.
Yeah, no, the book is full of those moments, even when it's talking about the more celebrated figures, like Widamu Priest, for example. And reading Widamu's story made me interested to know more about your kind of crafting. And did people contribute written chapters, or did you interview and then create their story on behalf?
So I really, where possible, and some of this was interrupted by flooding, so it was quite difficult, but where possible, I think there were only two people I didn't get to meet face-to-face, and I had to do online and phone interviews, but mostly because of a beautiful travel grant from Creative New Zealand, I was able to meet Kanohi Ki Te Kanohi face-to-face. And so, you know, like with Widamu, I was able to go up and spend time with him. I could meet his first little pony, Fafa, Arthur, but Fafa to Widamu. And I was able to go and watch him perform at Hoi, Horse of the Year. I could meet his mum and chat with her. And it just became a proper personal involvement rather than, here are some questions, would you answer them on paper? By speaking with someone, you can hear their turn of phrase, their tone of voice, the language tics that they use, and you can try to emulate them. And the reason I chose I narratives, you know, first-person narratives, was because I believe that people's stories belong to them. And so once I'd had a go at telling their story or retelling their story in a manner that resembled the way they'd told it to me, I'd send it to them and say, you know, how does this sound? And they'd say, oh, well, no, that's not correct. Could you change that? Or I like this better. Or no, not that word. That sounds ridiculous. And then we could change it and they'd be happy with it. And, you know, that would be great.
Yeah, I imagined a process somewhat like that, given that you're an author rather than an editor of this anthology. And so I do just have to congratulate you for capturing individuals' voice. And it really does make for very fresh reading. Even for a character whom we know, like Widamu Priest, you know, who's a well-known figure, reading his story in his voice is an absolute delight. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you. That means a lot.
There is a remarkable but not surprising, I think, although maybe it is a bit hidden, history and cultural relevance of horses for Māori that is represented really strongly in the book. So many of the people you write about, whakapapa Māori. So did the strength of that particular narrative and connection surprise you?
Not in the slightest. I mean, the richness of those stories, just incredible. From the story of Sir Hare Williams and his grandparents' taonga horse, who was Kaitiaki of their whānau, you know, this horse that took his grandmother up the hill to give her, I guess, one of her last insights into what would be Sir Hare's purpose and his family's purpose, and her reflections on history from that story to the young woman in Tūrangi competing in mounted games. And, you know, I'd never come across mounted games as, as a discipline. And or horse sports, which I went to see in Opotiki. And I have never seen such good sportsmanship. I've never seen such community spirit. I've never seen such fine treatment of hoiho. And just the way, you know, just the way in which the whole community comes together to support the event and the competitors, I just found incredibly moving. I also found it very humbling to watch these young women be so grateful for all of the help they were getting from borrowing horses from their mentors who had got them into mounted games, to the wonderful opportunity that one of them, Manaya, got to represent us in Italy. I mean, what a fantastic sport that you could just get to Italy by being good at mounted games and the support of your community.
Yeah.
I just thought that was magic, and I just support it 100%. I'm so, I get so excited by it now.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and that comes through all of that that you have just heard Joanna Emini talking about with such passion is represented in this beautiful book, Horses and Us, an anthology of stories published by Massey University Press. Buy it for your family bookshelf and share these stories with each other. They are the uplifting anecdote to and antidote to trashy memes and TikToks. So if you didn't, you might not have known your whānau needed that, but let me tell you, it does. It's available in bookstores and online. Thank you very much, Joanna.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
It's time for our monthly catch-up with Claudia from Scorpio. We're going to actually combine things today, Claudia. We're going to find out what's happening, what events are on at the bookshop. And then you're going to tell me who's buying what, or what's hot, or what we should be taking notice of. So let's start. April's coming up. Is it going to be another busy month?
Yes, I would say so. Although there is a bit of a trend appearing for Thursdays. So that's
okay.
I'm a Thursday night socializer. I think that sounds good. We will start rolling early April, Thursday the 2nd, 6 p.m. for our Scorpio Books Club. And this month, the Books Club will be discussing Half His Age by Jeanette McCurdy. I talked a bit about this book last time because it was my pick as a staff pick for book club. I think the book is complicated and got heaps of textures. Jeanette McCurdy is, of course, the best-selling author of I'm Glad My Mum Died, which was her memoir about being a child star. Quite a grueling, horrifying memoir. Fascinating, though. And, you know, for better or worse, Jeanette has come out the other side with such a knack for telling stories in engaging ways. And I thought Half His Age was a great read. Alarming. And no, just on the surface, I think a lot of the press and media about it has been, oh yeah, like look, another sort of dicey, inappropriate age gap relationship. But I think there's a lot more to it than that, and it's kind of selling it a bit short. There is an inappropriate relationship in the book between the high school student and her English teacher, but the novel's much more interested in looking at the two of them as people trying to trying to use the relationship in their own different ways rather than just kind of like, you know, slapping the red tape on it and saying, this is a bad thing, you know? So there's that Scorpio Books Club, and it's $10 to attend. But the great thing about our books club is you don't have to lock into a year at a time or anything like that. You can just come and go as you please, as the books interest you. Thursday, the 9th of April, we're doing an offsite event. We're going to be selling books at Littleton Coffee Company for the launch of The Clean by Richard Langston. A lot of locals will have heard that this book is on the way. It's being published by Auckland University Press, and they're doing a four-part tour to promote the release of the book. The Canterbury version is occurring on Thursday, the 9th of April, and it's going to be, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I mean, we obviously know Littleton is Kilgore country, you know, Hamish
Kilgore
lived there many years.
Yeah.
Ran into him all the time, always hopping up on stage at gigs at the Loons. So I think it'll be a lot of friends and family at this event. And it sounds like, I mean, I obviously, I'm much too young to have been, you know,
a Clean fan.
When The Clean were around.
And I'm a bit too old. We're at either end.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're missing that middle slide.
Yeah.
But it sounds like a great book. And obviously they have a really interesting story. You know, I saw this bit in the media about how they made the single Tally Ho, which I have heard of, for only $50, which is a bargain. And I'm sure inflation doesn't have much to do with that. And yeah, Richard Langston obviously is a journalist and he's a poet. So
yes,
the poets
he is. Yeah. Commonly here is poetry on Radio New Zealand. And a great writer and obviously a Clean fan.
Big time. Mm. Yeah, he edited the zine, right, Garage, which was a big deal in the 80s. So props for the being a poet and the zine making. We love an interdisciplinary writer. So that'll be lots of fun. So come on down and hear all about The Clean and from their nearest and dearest as well, which I think will put quite a lovely spin on things. Coming up in the week after that, Thursday, 16th of April, we have the launch of Pepeha Portal by Ariana Takal, published by Otago University Press. So Ariana is a kaitahu writer. She's a local. She's a New Zealand Arts Laureate, which is quite a big deal. She's also known as a poet, but interestingly, this book is her first poetry collection.
Now, that really surprised me.
Isn't that surprising?
Yes.
So I've just always known her as a poet
and
sort of therefore assumed there was this big back catalogue. But no, this is her first collection. And the poems were mostly written around 2023 when she was awarded the Ursula Bethel Residency at the University of Canterbury. And she was, you know, she did grow up in Christchurch, but then she left after the quakes and then came back. And the poems are about that kind of returning, coming back to the landscape and seeing what's been exposed by all the shifts. So I think it's going to be a really special night. Ariana's also in a play at the Court Theatre, which is opening the next night. So it's a very busy time for her and a very busy time for Ariana Takal fans. They'll have their week sorted. And we're looking forward to this one. Ariana's a big fan of the bookshop, and her earlier book, Mokorua, the story of Mokokowai, was a big hit at Scorpio too. Mm.
And she was sure to be singing and playing her music. So, you know, it'll be a multi-layered evening, won't it?
It will,
of delight. Yeah.
Once again, interdisciplinary poets coming to the fore. The next night, something a bit special, something a bit different. I've organised a harvest party at Scorpio Books for Friday the 17th of April at 6 p.m. And now this was inspired by The Food Farm. I don't know if you were around for Angela Clifford and Nick Gill's launch at Scorpio last year.
I wasn't, but I think we interviewed them for the program.
Yeah, they're based out in Amberley. They run an organics farm. They teach people how to use, you know, how to farm organically and how to really use the land they've got. And at their book launch, Angela talked about this tradition they have at The Food Farm for celebrating Halloween in April, which is when it would occur seasonally in the Northern Hemisphere. So they do all the kind of Halloween-y stuff, but they do it at the sort of the right time of year. They call it the proper Halloween. Sorry, the real Halloween. And this sounded like a lot of fun to me. So I floated it with Angela whether we could do something like that at Scorpio. And Angela and Nick were dead keen. So they're gonna bring along some pumpkins. There might be a bit of pumpkin carving. They're going to talk to us about what to do in the garden at this, that sort of time of year. We have one of Scorpio's very own staff members, Isabel McNeur, publishing under the name Isabel Taylor. Isabel has a book coming out called Accidentally Wedded to a Werewolf. Have you heard about this?
I haven't, but I should, because Isabel came through the Hagley Writers Institute
when I was there,
and she was hugely talented.
Yeah, and also been published in Starling over the years, the youth journal. Isabel has a book coming out called Accidentally Wedded to a Werewolf. It's the first book in a series, which I understand is already well on the way to having several phases written. It's a fantasy romance novel. It's, you know, a bit cozy. It's a small town. It sounds like lots of fun. Isabel's going to read to us from this book. We will also have other local writers on the bill. We've got Kerry Donovan Brown reading from their new unpublished manuscript, which I believe is sort of science fiction fantasy. It's got dinosaurs in there too. Sort of, you know, more sort of magical things happening. Kerry is the author of Lamplighter from 2014, which is one of my staff picks, set in a sort of speculative fiction Waikuku Beach. You don't get many novels set in Waikuku Beach. Which is interesting because it's a beautiful place. And I found Lamplighter a very winning book, you know, like I really enjoyed the kind of foggy mystery of it all. And I think more people should read Lamplighter. And also on the lineup, we have Isla Huia. Now, Isla is the author of Talia, which was shortlisted for the Book Awards in 2023. Isla is also working on a forthcoming collection being published by Dead Bird Books in the wintertime. So Isla's going to share some of her new poems with us, which we are very much looking forward to. And there you go. That's our harvest party. That's our way of kind of signalling the end of the
array of all sorts of things. I can't even think of the right collective noun for what you've got going there.
I wanted it to feel kind of loamy and a bit kind of, you know, the sort of inspirational words were gothic and chthonic and things like that, you know, like let's get in the mood. It's going to be a cold winter if this summer is anything to go by. So like, why not have some fun with it? And we will, of course, be serving drinks and nibbles. It's free. Come one, come all. It'll be a fun night. That's Friday, 17th of April. And from here, I have the What's Hot, the bestsellers. It's
good. Let's go.
Does that sound like a good time to transition?
Yep.
I don't know if we've talked about this yet, Maureen, but somewhat predictably, the top New Zealand fiction title so far this month is The Black Monk by Charlotte Grimshaw.
How surprising.
Have you read it yet?
I have read it, and I have talked to Charlotte. And I had, I have reservations about it.
Yes, I finished it this morning. So.
But it was, I enjoyed talking to Charlotte and voicing some of those reservations with her about, you know, going back to the family and utilising her family stories again, but this time it's not the first time she's used it in fiction.
It makes you think about that that phrase that gets bandied around with, I think, poetry more than fiction, but maybe it applies to novelists too, about how writers are always sort of rewriting one or two stories just over and over again their whole careers, right?
Mm.
And I haven't read any of Charlotte's other books, so I don't really know that.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, I think I would have read just about everything she's written. Mm. So, there was a lot that was familiar to me in this book. But, you know, I'm interested in your take on it as somebody who hasn't read those things, who's come to it new.
Yeah, so I'm pretty tough, and I tend to, if I'm not in a book after 50 pages, I just don't finish it. I just put it aside. Life's too short. Mm. But I did finish The Black Monk. I did find it compelling enough to keep reading it. And I was curious about a lot of the techniques that Grimshaw was using. You know, I kind of wondered at the repetitiveness of some of the phrases and the way that characters, not including the narrator, but other characters were kind of brought into the story with a quick sort of pricey sketch of how they are known to Alice, and then we're moving on, you know? And it had that kind of sketchy quality of, you know, like, is this a bit of a, like a, is this a draft, you know? Are we one step back from something fully polished, and is that a technique? Is that something that's been done on purpose to kind of add to the metafiction feeling that goes through the novel? Yeah, so I kind of had a lot of head scratchy moments, and but I ultimately enjoyed it. I finished it. Otherwise, it made me a little bit. I shared my concerns with some friends, and it made me a bit worried about how, like, you know, are people just not writing characters anymore? Is that out? You know, but I can see that in Charlotte in Grimshaw's case, it's very likely a consciously chosen technique. I'm not sure that it's my taste. You know?
No, I think absolutely. I think it's all been done very mindfully, shall we say, or very consciously. Yeah.
So there we go. The Black Monk. It's selling. People are interested. I look forward to the heated discussions at the bar all about it.
Yes, me too.
Moving along, we have also probably predictably How to Paint a Nude by Sam Mahon has jumped back up into the New Zealand fiction bestsellers for us. Sam has been shortlisted for the Book Awards. Sam's a hoot. It's autobiographical, it's political autofiction is how I would describe the book. And it has a beautiful cover. Props to Sam on that too. So if you haven't already given that a go, back the locals, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you've got any knowledge of or interest in the local art scene, you will be either intrigued or enraged by Sam's account of where public art, you know, and versus politics, blah blah blah, all those things. Yep, all in there. Yep.
Hot button issues.
Yes.
Other big sellers this month, we have 1985 by Dominic Hoey, longlisted for the Book Awards.
Brilliant book, in my opinion.
Oh, okay. Very good.
Yeah,
I noticed there's an audiobook, so I might give the audiobook a go because I quite like the idea of hearing it in his voice. I would do it in my head anyway, but, you know, nice to have.
And as an aside, we have Dominic living in Christchurch this
Yes,
year,
that's right.
Yeah.
Recent migrant to the south.
Yes.
And then also in the bestsellers for us, we have more of a form title than a fiction title, but A Day Like No Other by James Norcliffe, which we launched earlier in the month. Been a steady seller. It's a beautiful book. James was wonderful to hear from at his launch, clearly very moved by the support, and his son gave a really lovely speech, and Eric Kennedy, of course, too. It was a really, really nice night. So if you're in for some poetry and you want to see James across the decades, I highly recommend picking up A Day Like No Other. He read some of his work from around the Springbok tour, which I found quite interesting. I sort of when you win a life for something that big, but it does form a large part of the kind of country's consciousness about race and sport. Hearing people talk about that period of history is quite fascinating. Yes, I'll press on, shall I?
Yes.
In New Zealand nonfiction, our top sellers have been Money, Money, Money by Rachel Davies and Angela Mayer. And I went to this launch and I thought it was fascinating. They did this great role play where they had one of them dressed up like money, like the sort of the abstraction of money. And as part of the way that they wanted the book to be received by people, you know, it's about changing attitudes and kind of thinking about why money makes you think the way you do about it. And one of the techniques they use in their workshops is role play. So they get someone to sort of pretend to be money, and then the other person talks to them and sort of says, you know, why do I feel like I do about you? You know, like, let's sort of let's tease that out, which I found really fun, you know.
What a great way of challenging, provoking people to think about their relationship with money.
Yeah. It certainly it was new to me. We've actually sold a lot of economic and sort of money titles this month. I'll just sort of hop around a wee bit. But one of our, like, international bestsellers has been The Barefoot Investor. And now we can't really seem to stop selling this. You know, it keeps coming in and it keeps going out. And I'm actually one of the people who's bought it and read it, and I found it really helpful. Something that I think Rachel and Angela did quite well with Money, Money, Money is they sort of specified at the beginning of the launch, look, you know you can't budget your way out of poverty. That's not what this book is about. It's about, you know, psychology and how you think about money, you know. Whereas the Barefoot Investor is probably more for people who have a job or jobs and are earning money and are trying to get themselves out of debt, you know. Like, I wouldn't recommend it to somebody like a student who, you know, isn't earning at the moment. It's not for that phase of your life. How much more time have we got, Maureen?
We've done 17 minutes, so maybe one last book to wrap up.
Yeah, sure. We, in the international fiction department, I mean, there's a few books I could just quickly touch on. We've got Theo of Golden by Alan Levi selling really well. Belle's read this one, and she described it as, like, very inspirational for fans of Paulo Coelho, you know, the alchemist, that style of inspirational fiction. Heated Rivalry by Rachel Reed and many of its sequels. This is the gay ice hockey thing. It's going crazy. We're selling heaps of it. So if you want a copy, get in quick. And then I think maybe more in the more sort of interesting line, things that have come out, Brawler by Lauren Groff. Fantastic short stories. Very dark, very kind of
Big fan of hers. So, yes, I might have to get myself a copy of that.
110%. I loved it. We all gobbled it up. Yeah.
Well, thank you. That's been thoroughly inspirational and educational and very wide-ranging look at what's going on. And congratulations for having such an enticing lot of events going on at Scorpio, Claudia. And good to hear what people are reading, what's taking their fancy. And thank you, as always, for your support of our program. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.